You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we told you about DeSantis and Florida before anyone else. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, the hopeful bromantic, and that title is super important for this episode, perhaps more than most episodes we've ever done of this show. We've got a lot to talk about in regards to art and the intersection of art and culture. I think it's going to be an interesting episode because the main thing that really happened this week is sort of fucking insane. It's insane from my perspective, especially the person we're going to be talking about. You know, we're going to be talking about Jordan Peterson, where it's not decided where everyone stands on him. Jordan Peterson is interesting to me because so many people have different perspectives on him, whether he's good, whether he's bad, what kind of value he presents. It's all over the map. And it makes it really interesting what happened to him in our culture this week, in our art this week. But first, before we go deeper into that and some other things, I have to bring in my co-host joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, another wonderful week here in California. Looking forward to some exciting, my first kickball game today, and Remy, my little puppy, went to, I've been jokingly calling it preschool. He's going to his puppy training. And so so far he's gotten straight A's on his little puppy report card. I feel super bougie. But it's a great chance for him to get some training, get some socialization in these COVID times, since we're all unable to properly socialize here in California.
Do you feel bougie because he got straight A's, or do the fact that he simply has a puppy report card?
The fact that he has a puppy report card is enough to make me feel like this is the most California way to do this.
The most California way is, and I wonder, you know, your dog has straight A's, so your dog is an overachiever, right? Your dog, clearly your white privilege is rubbing off on your dog. But are there other dogs?
He is an Australian shepherd, so, I mean, that automatically gets him colonialism too, right?
Yeah. Well, Australian, is he like a descendant of, like, prison dogs?
I don't know. That's a good question. Probably running the prison, though, unfortunately, right?
Yeah, we just pissed off our Australian audience pretty bad. No, the most California thing would be not the dogs who get straight A's. Do the dogs who don't get good grades, do they get participation medals?
I should have brought the report card up here because it's either like A or like I think the last one in I'll have to pull it, I'll take a picture of it and post it on Discord. The if they need work, it's something like needs work but still cute.
So that's inspired by the Instagram generation where you look
exactly
at most girls' profiles, and that's what you say. Needs work, but still cute. It's interesting that they still use the A, though. You would think that would be, like, oppressive or something. Anyway.
Well, there's still time. There's still time.
There is still time. They need to improve their methods. One more thing about California I want to ask you about. You must be excited for June 15th.
Yeah, the pandemic is over. I mean, we declared it over a while back, didn't we? I even forgot the date we declared it over. But,
yeah, we declared it over like a month and a half, 2 months ago. But yeah. California reopening June 15th shows that there is no ground to stand on anymore. The NFL expects full attendance and games in the fall. Disney World's opening up its new Ratatouille ride in Epcot and doing a 50th year anniversary celebration in October. The pandemic's over. I think they're just waiting for the school year to end so they can say, okay, here's a cutoff date where most people, you know, can get used to the fact of not wearing masks anymore and things.
Wait, you think they're going to allow us to not wear masks?
I'm putting it out there in the world. I'm hopeful. I don't think that.
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's going to be us mask rebels for a little while before, especially in California. I mean, we look at not to get too deep in the COVID stuff, but you know, Michigan had a little uptick because of the cold weather, but now it's already on decline again, and you know, California is. Been declining as the weather has been getting nicer, and there's no reason. My friend and I tried desperately to find a place to play pool last night, because we were just like, man, it's been like a year and a half since we've played pool, and we just couldn't find a place that was open that actually were letting people play pool. Is that such a far cry? How many deaths? What's the acceptable death rate of COVID before I'm allowed to play pool?
California was big with the charts. I wish they would have just given us that chart. All right, let's get into it. Hit the music. Take a good look around. This life really sucks. Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all that. If you would like to reward us, reward me for terrible transitions like the one I just did, you can do so through Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode, Locals is per month. You can do so. We appreciate any and all support. You know, that's how this show, we get rewarded for it. The other way you can give it, you know, is affirmations. We appreciate that as well. So themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/locals. And to get started with this episode, I have a couple questions I want to throw at William. One's on the outline. One is not. One is not because I sort of just encountered it in our Discord, and I'll plug the Discord a little bit later. But, you know, somebody shared a comic panel by Mark Millar. Mark Millar is, a comic writer who, he did Kick-Ass, he did The Kingsman. You know, he's had some pretty good works adapted, right? I like Kick-Ass. I like Mark Millar. Pretty generally, his worldview is pretty good. But this panel that was shared, it's a couple panels, is he actually drew Ayn Rand. He drew Ayn Rand into this book called Jupiter's Legacy, which is being adapted by Netflix, directed by Robert Rodriguez. We're not talking about the trailer this week, maybe next week. I had already done it when people started talking about this in the Discord. But in it, you know, she talks about how the superheroes use their powers to enforce their superiority, especially on the parasites who refuse to accept it. And I'm not interested in like getting into the philosophy of that. That's so obviously a mistake, William, that like going into like how that's second-handed is sort of like stupid. You know, I put a tweet out about it. It's, you know, if you want to read the tweet, go ahead. It's out there. It's on my timeline. What's more interesting to me, William, is how people can't distinguish between objectivism and Ayn Rand. And I understand Ayn Rand, quote unquote, created objectivism, but it's the same thing between distinguishing between an artist and his art, you know, distinguishing between Zack Snyder and his movies. And to me, the fundamental premises of objectivism hold, even if perhaps Ayn Rand misapplied them or she said things that I may not personally agree with. Again, I think this is a mischaracterization of what Millar wrote, is a mischaracterization of objectivism, but he's specifically talking about the journal that Ayn Rand wrote about the serial killer Hickman, right? And I've never had any interest in caring about that, but people will bring it up as if, aha, Ayn Rand said this, so her entire philosophical system is flawed and should be thrown out the window. And I don't get that way. I have never had, and this, I guess, distinguishes me from a lot of objectivists, I have never had an allegiance to Ayn Rand in that way. I just like the ideas and I agree with the ideas. What do you think about all that I just said?
Yeah, I guess I'm not as familiar with this letter about William Hickman, so maybe that context is completely over my head. Yeah.
Well, isn't that kind of the point? Before you continue, isn't that kind of the point? You're someone who, like me, I think you appreciate the same things about the ideas as me, and I think you have a similar sense of life as I do, and you're not aware of it. But these people who don't like Ayn Rand and don't like objectivism love to trot it out, and that's what they're familiar with. Isn't that the entire point?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like there's a part that matters in the sense of if someone's trying to live out their philosophy, that you can look at it and say, well, how well did it work out for them, right? And that's that. I mean, that is certainly a valid way to look at it, but you still have to look at the ideas separate from the person, right? Because do they work in reality is still down to the character and the experiences and the choices of the person. And
right.
You know, people can make mistakes, and they can have errors in judgment and errors of knowledge, right? And so, like, all those things are interesting. They're just not super interesting to me. They're not so interesting that I know what this letter to William Hickman is all about, or would it have any like major like revelation about like whether I agree or disagree with the fundamentals of objectivism? Like, it would have nothing to do with that, right?
Right, exactly. And I think you're distinguishing between, and I'm going to use the word that I typically use that I don't think enough people use, the application of the philosophy and the philosophy is very important, because somebody can discover a system of work, a system that works. That doesn't mean that they apply it. I mean, let's take the TB12 method, right? Tom Brady obviously uses it, but his trainer, Alex, I think Gonzalez, I may be misquoting his last name and come across racist because he's Hispanic, so sorry, nobody get mad at me. I don't remember his last name exactly. But his trainer obviously doesn't apply it. He understands it, and he helps Tom Brady use it, and he helps run the TB12 centers, and he obviously believes in it if he's doing these things. But is that a strike against the method if it doesn't work? Because he's not applying it as much as Tom Brady is? No. And I'm sure we can go through history and look at people who have made scientific discoveries and haven't lived by them. What about scientists who study metabolism and nutrition? Do you think every one of those people were in really good shape and really healthy? What about physical trainers, athletic trainers who train people, but they themselves are not in top-notch shape? Now, I've said before, I think that's poor rhetoric. I think that's bad marketing, but that doesn't mean they don't understand the methods and don't believe they work and don't get them to work for other people. So I don't understand this. And I think this is the major thing that's a problem in our culture in general, and specifically with objectivism. Is I don't think the actual ideas are ever discussed, William. I think it all becomes about, oh, this is Ayn Rand, and because of Ayn Rand, and there are things Ayn Rand did, and this is, you know, something that could potentially piss off objectivists. So there are things Ayn Rand did that I don't agree with in her personal life and the way she acted that I don't think are related to the philosophy, and I can distinguish between the two. I really don't care what kind of music Ayn Rand liked. I don't care what kind of dance she liked. I may agree with her fundamental premises about romanticism, about aesthetics. That doesn't mean I have to agree with her applications of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of optionality in there, and it, not just that, but for me, it comes back to the. What standard do you use to adopt ideas, right? Epistemologically, is it about, I keep coming back to, it matters in the sense of like how to apply it. That is interesting, right? You can use that, but, you know, if someone comes up to me and says, eating grains aren't healthy for you, and then proceeds to eat a bunch of grains, right, in front of me, like, that won't change the fact that, at least for me, you know, eating grains is not healthy for me, right? And it won't change the idea, it won't discredit the idea by the person who's saying it, whether they eat grains or not.
Right. It might discredit whether you want to model yourself after that person's lifestyle nutritionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't discredit the idea about not eating grains. And I certainly would not run my personal life the way Ayn Rand ran her personal life.
No. Yeah.
Right. So that's just something that is, it's literally on the edge of my brain, because it came up literally this morning in the last couple hours before the podcast. So I just wanted to run that by you, because it's just, I mean, I guess I was aware of it, but I wasn't like consciously aware of like the distinguishing between Ayn Rand and the philosophy. And it seems that no one ever refutes objectivism. They refute Ayn Rand. And those are two different things.
Yeah, especially since one of them is not around to refute.
Right. It's refute, like, hey, let's dunk on this dead person. But that's our culture, isn't it? Just dunking on people.
Hashtag canceled.
Cancel Ayn Rand, even though she's dead. Switching gears a little bit, there's something else I want to talk to you about. We're going back to the outline now. Something that you have a level of expertise in. And it's a term I've seen coming up more and more over the past just the past couple weeks. And I have to ask you about something that I really cannot wrap my head around. I've talked to Daniel about it off show a little bit, and I want to get your perspective on it, because I don't understand the value of it on a general level. William, what the fuck is an NFT? Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, an NFT... there's sort of two answers to that. So, an NFT it's been around for a while. I don't know why it's suddenly getting so popular, but,
you've seen it over the past couple weeks, right?
I have. I've seen it. I've been following it over the past couple weeks, but I mean, it's been around for a while. The concept of it's been around for a while.
Right, which is part of why I'm asking you about it, 'cause I'm really fucking confused as to why all of a sudden it's like, oh, NFT is everywhere.
Well, let's get into what it is first. So it's a non-fungible token. It's a way to have a unique digital thing that can be represented in a blockchain, so that you can express ownership and do things like mathematically provably say that this item is owned by someone. And you're doing that just digitally. So to really boil it down, it's sort of like a deed to a house, right? But except for it's not a piece of paper, it's the original, or it's not a copy of the deed, right? It is the deed. It's the actual thing, and it can't be copied the actual bits can be copied, but the proof of who owns that can't be replicated except for by the owner.
Okay, I'm with you. So I'm with you that like it's a way of mathematically having property rights in the digital age. Mm-hmm. I'm with you 100%, right? So a deed is sort of a metaphor for you own this property in reality. And right. That's sort of difficult to do in the digital age, because everything is not real. Everything's abstract, right? It's on the computer. It's digital.
Right, everything's copyable, right?
Right, everything's copyable. Right. So I'm with you 100%. And that makes sense for something like Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin, correct me if I'm wrong, is an NFT.
So sort of, yes. Like the way the wallets work are not, if you keep your private key private, it's not copyable, right? But anyone could have, like, you could give that private key to other people, and then, you know, it could be copyable, right? The whole concept of or at least the theory of the NFT is to try to make it so that it's provable who owns it, and that proof can't be forged, right? Like, who owns that can't be forged. So yes, it's similar. Like, it's actually usually done in Ethereum, because Ethereum has this concept of contracts, and so this is kind of implemented as a contract. But yeah, it's enabled by the same technology that Bitcoin uses and other crypto services use.
Okay, so I get that. That all makes sense. I get it with cryptocurrency. All that makes sense. You know, if you wanted to say, like, you own this server and things like that, could you use an NFT for that?
I think right now most of it is like digital art, so it's like stills, videos, audio, URLs.
Now we're getting to where I'm confused.
Yeah.
This is where I'm really fucking confused about, okay? I really, like, I don't get it. Like, for instance, WWE will send out, like, marketing emails, like, buy stuff from us, right? And this is WrestleMania, right? We're recording this on the Sunday of day two of WrestleMania. And one of the emails they sent out was, like, now selling Undertaker NFTs, right?
Okay.
I don't get it. And this is why I don't get it. And this is part of the conversation I had with Daniel. Is like, I get there's the original Mona Lisa hanging in the Louvre, right? And you want to be able to prove that that's the original. I understand that because he painted that by hand. And then other replicas of the Mona Lisa were not painted by hand by Picasso. So there is a different value to those copies, right? But in the digital age, let's take the example of the Snyder Cut. Once the Snyder Cut is made and exported, that's the original version, right? It's made in whatever digital audio or digital editing software they use. That's exported. You can call that the original copy, so you can call that an NFT or whatever. But then they upload it to HBO Max. And let's say somebody figures out a way to download it or screen grab it, and it's the exact same quality. Why does it matter being able to prove it's the original? Why do I need the NFT? I don't understand.
Yeah, I think that gets back to how we protect digital copyright. And so I think in that sense, you would say, like, let's say you painted a digitally, right? You digitally created a beautiful piece of art for one of our Midside shirts that you can get at themidside.com/store. And you wanted to take that final before it went on the shirt. And you wanted to create an NFT, you'd go to Ethereum, you'd create an Ethereum wallet, you'd go to one of these trading houses, pay the $100 to set it up. You could choose whether it's a collectible of one or whether it's a collectible of five or something. And then you would sell those, basically you're selling the rights, the copyright, right? The ownership, that people could do whatever they wanted with that thing. They actually own that thing. So in a sense, you're giving up, in a way, the copyright of that work, right? Just like you would sell it to, you know, I don't know, whoever, like if you were just an artist and you were just selling a drawing, a physical drawing, you're giving it up and you're transferring that ownership to the other person. So they could do whatever they wanted with it. They could trade it with other folks. They could print more shirts, right? They could use it on a whatever, you know, like that would all be part of the, think of it as your license, right? For that particular good.
So then could it be used sort of to not let people reproduce? And what I mean by that is, I feel like somebody's going to like take that quote out and be like, to not let people reproduce, he's pro castration. Like, no, that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, man.
What I'm talking about is, right? Yeah, definitely get that drop. What I'm talking about is, let's use the example of the Snyder Cut, for instance. Say somebody downloaded that, and then they wanted to create and sell Blu-rays or 4K discs. And it's not the original because it doesn't have the NFT signature in it. Could there be, and this is where libertarians may disagree with me, legitimately a function of government, could there be a database where the company that's been hired to make the physical discs or distribute the physical discs can cross-reference the file that's submitted to them with a database that has the NFT in it or a record of the NFT. So they wouldn't have the actual NFT, but whatever the signature of the NFT is.
I see where you're going. So the idea here is, I'm sure some of the libertarians from liberty.me will help guide me if I go astray here, but the idea here is that the ownership proof, that database you're talking about, is decentralized. It's in the blockchain, so there's no need for any government in that part. So determining the order is objective for everyone to see. Now, but whether people respect that, right, let's get into this. Whether people respect that or not is sort of up to the general public, insofar as do they respect the blockchain. That being said, right, that is where, you know, us as a little more objectivist leaning folks would say, oh, and then the role of government here is to enforce that copyright, that property right.
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 If
people start, you know, if people, you know, start blatantly copying the Zack Snyder's Justice League and, you know, someone, you know, Zack Snyder says, hey, that they aren't using the, you know, the NFT version, right? Like I own that version. I proved it on this, you know, on this one of one. This is a unique digital asset, and any copies of it are copies of this, right?
Right. So Snyder could have a contract with HBO Max or Warner Media or AT&T that says you can stream my NFT version of my movie on HBO Max, but that doesn't give other people a right to stream it, distribute it, make art based upon it, right? Make products based upon it.
Yeah, and to be clear, so, it's not that you're putting the movie in the blockchain, right? So when you say the NFT version, that's kind of a little bit of a misspeak, right?
So something that I'm learning about, I'm speaking improperly about. Oh no! Of course, I'm a fucking idiot.
I just wanted to make sure we drew the distinction there. It's the NFT is the proof of ownership, not the thing itself. Usually, right? Like for a very small piece of art, you could actually put it on the blockchain, right? Like a pixel art, you could put it on the blockchain, right? But if you're
NFT is not built into the code of the digital thing. That was my understanding.
The NFT is built into the code of the digital thing. No, it is a yes and no. Yes, in some cases it can be. No, it can just be, think of it as just like a digital signature of the thing too, right?
Let me ask you this then, just so I'm trying to get a concrete understanding of this. I own let's go back to the example of the physical media distribution. I own a physical media production company, a physical media distribution company, right? I can make a Blu-ray disc for you. I can make a 4K disc for you. I can send it out. You submit your movie to me. Do I also have to ask for the NFT? So I say, send me the movie file, but also send me the NFT that proves you own the movie file. Is that how it works?
No. What you would send is proof. You would send proof. Yes, I own this movie. That proof, you would then check the NFT on the blockchain and see if I'm telling the truth.
Okay. Got it.
You would send your proof of ownership, right? And then mathematically, I could look at the blockchain, look at the NFT and say, oh, yeah, you do own this. Okay, I'll make copies for you.
Okay. So I'm on board now. Like, I get the value of NFT. This is something I've hated for a long time. Like, even when Lost was airing, like, people would make T-shirts on, like, Teespring or whatever the site, or Cafe Press it was back in the day, and they'd sell Lost merchandise, and they're making money off of somebody else's intellectual property, and I always hated that, right? To me, that was dishonest. It's like, what gives you the right to make that? You have nothing to do with it. You're just capitalizing on it. It's the same thing with flippers, right? I mean, and maybe that's a way we can combat flippers too, right? You buy this product, but you're not the original person. You know, show me the proof and I'll check it on the blockchain to see whether you're the original person. Then we just don't buy from you. All right, same type of, so I'm on board here. It seems to me like someone like WWE is misapplying the concept of the NFT, where they're like, oh, we're going to sell you Undertaker NFTs. It seems like they're not understanding. It's the purpose is to protect their intellectual property, not to be like, oh, well, I'm going to sell you this 1 in 200,000 digital thing and you have the NFT for it. That seems to me like,
yeah, well, it it's something that you couldn't really do with digital media, that they're trying to bring the property, the physical good analogy into the digital space. So making, like, let's say, you know, for your latest pop punk album, you're only going to sell 100,000 collector copies, right? Physical copies, right? Now you could do that with NFTs. You could say, I'm only selling 100,000 digital collector copies. Now, everyone might get the music on Spotify, right? But there's only 100,000 of these digital versions, right? Only 100,000 people can own that version.
Yeah, but that's...
And it can even be exactly the same. I mean, a physical collector's version is really not that different from a, you know, music-wise, from the regular version of an album, right?
Right. Well, that's where they lose me. That's like where people collect the stickers for Funko Pops, right? Because you could do the same thing for Funko Pops. You could have Funko Pop NFTs where it's like, oh, there are only 1,000 NFTs for this one Funko Pop that's released digitally, and they never make a physical copy. But the difference for me when you're buying limited edition Funko Pops, right? Oh, there's only like 1,008 of Black Suit Superman from Man of Steel made, and I own one of them, right? That's different because it exists in reality. You can hold it, you can touch it, you can see it with the five senses. And there was more effort and resources that were taken, or sorry, that were used when creating that. Whereas digitally, if I sell, oh, well, there's only 1,000 of this digital Funko Pop, then it's not the same because it's easy to recreate that. And you can have a lot more of it because it doesn't take many resources. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's still this desire to say that you can have, you know, 10 digital units of something, right? Because otherwise that concept doesn't really make sense. But I'm just saying that here it would make sense in a way.
Yeah, no, I get how it makes sense with the NFT. I just don't think the scarcity thing... I think they're using it improperly. Like, I get 100%. Like, I get it as a way to protect digital property. Like, I get that 100%. I get that as a way to protect digital intellectual property. I'm on board with that 100%. But I think the way it's being used currently is a way to create an artificial sense of scarcity when that's just a mind game. There is no scarcity for these digital products. It's like you said. The music is the same, whether you say it's an NFT or not. It's not the same thing as saying we're only making 100 of the black vinyl, and that's all that exists.
Yeah.
Now, I know people can physically make other exact knockoffs of that, but it's different. It's not the same production process, or it's not made by the band. It's the same thing of making knockoff shoes or whatever.
Well, and when it comes to collectors, that concept, though, does matter, right? Because like you said, someone can go press a vinyl and it be exactly the same as the, you know, 100 run original, you know, Elvis Presley album or something, right? You can go make an album today that is identical to that album, but no one would pay for it, right?
Right, no, that's why
Whereas
I use Funko
they would
Pops.
Pay for the one that was made then, right?
Right. I won't buy knockoffs of Funko Pops made in China. But I'll buy the originals. Like, I get it. I get it 100% physically. But again, there's a difference to me in exerting the effort in actual reality versus digitally just slapping an NFT on it. I don't know. Maybe I'm old.
Yeah.
Maybe my age
is
finally betraying me.
That's your physical privilege.
Sure.
What if someone's only digital? How are they supposed to? How are they supposed to do this?
I will always privilege physical reality over digital space. So
how dare you?
Something to track over the rest of our lives, right? About halfway through our lives here, we'll see what happens over the rest of it. Oh. All right, let's move on. Let's move on to some cultural stuff. I mean, that was a cultural thing, but let's move on to like an artistic cultural discussion. That was sort of more on the marketing business side of it, commerce side of it. Something that was crazy this week, William, is I was shocked when I found this out. So Coates, the guy who's going to be writing the new Man of Steel movie, or they announced it, right? That he would be, I don't even want to say new Man of Steel, new Superman. I misspoke. I apologize. He's going to be writing the new Superman movie. Also wrote an arc in the comics for Marvel, for Captain America, of Red Skull. And he made Red Skull parallel Jordan Peterson. I was William, when Jordan Peterson started tweeting about this, and I don't even follow Peterson anymore, right? And people started retweeting it. I was shocked. What about you?
I thought it was hilarious. I don't know if shocked is the right word. I thought the memes were hilarious. People were just, you know, saying stuff like, you know, make your bed and showing like something, some super violent Red Skull thing. And someone wrote a Jordan, like, made Jordan Peterson like into like a villain superhero, like shouting phrases like make your bed and clean your room and things like that, you know, all the things that he says in his book and his rules. I don't know if shocked was the right term. I think This is how they see people who, this is you know, tribalism par excellence, right? Like, this is exactly what it is. He is outside of their tribe, and this is and somehow still a threat. Like, I don't know why he's still a threat, but apparently still a threat. So yeah, I think it's funny. I mean, what better way to market it? I think I don't remember if it was your boy Zach over at the comic book YouTube channel, or if it was even Matt Skyver, but someone was pointing out that you could read like some of the speeches by Red Skull in like a couple years back, and they sound like they're reasonable, right? And then the further back you go, the more like actual like evil Red Skull is, right? He's sort of like, just like the Overton window, he basically comes back to where he sounds like a conservative now, right? Like, there's some stuff that's obviously like they sort of like inflate and make like evil, right? But he's like basically saying like, you know, things about immigration, like that was the last Red Skull was talking about, like, you know, people are coming and, you know, they're not being, you know, not integrating with the culture and blah, blah, blah. So it's sort of conservative talking points. And that's considered the evil Nazi in the comic books now. Right. It's just crazy.
Well, right. That's why it's so insane to me. Like there's a double level here to what you're saying. The first is, this is Winter Soldier, the movie, and why I don't like the movie. If you remember Winter Soldier, the whole thing was about, you know, there was a computer program or device that could anticipate what people were going to do. And they were worried that basically S.H.I.E.L.D., who had been taken over by Hydra, who were Nazis, were going to use that to get rid of their political enemies before their political enemies acted. This was all just a giant metaphor for what the left was afraid the right was going to do. But of course, that's pure projection, right? So I don't get why. Let me say it this way. I get why people say Winter Soldier is a good movie. It's the propaganda they've been fed, and it's the tribalism, as you're saying, that they're used to. Oh, well, this side is evil, and that makes this movie good because it's pointing that out, even though it's a complete fucking fantasy, right? The acting like the right wing is Nazis, right? We saw this over the past 4 years, but that's why the word Overton window, the phrase Overton window was so good for you to use. When you look at Jordan Peterson, and I said this at the top of the show, William, what's so interesting is how everyone on every side disagrees about him, right? People on the right say he's too far left. People on the left say he's too far right. And all he's really doing is he's creating ideas as an academic. He's a pure academic that he thinks are a view of the correct way to look at the world, especially for men. And because he's came out as critical for feminism, that's why the left hated him. But the right hated him because he says he thinks government's the answer. And he thinks that, you know, we need a larger government to fix the world. And look, like I was saying earlier in the show as well, there are good things about what he says and there are bad things about what he says. I own his book, right? The 10 rules or whatever it is. I'm going to be honest. I didn't ever get through it. He writes like an academic. I think he's very unnecessarily verbose. It was not enjoyable to read. But are there good things in what he's saying? Yeah. Do I agree with everything about what he's saying? No, but I'm not required to agree with everything everyone says. So it's interesting to me that this writer, and I don't even want to say the left, I just want to say this writer dislikes him so much that they would say he's a Nazi. Like, that's, to me, William, that shows a level of artistic, philosophical, and psychological corruption, and it's corruption of Marvel that they would hire someone like that. How are we to that point that someone like that is hired? You have the chance to make a statement about evil. You have a chance to make a statement about Nazism, right? Because Red Skull is ultimately a Nazi. And your idea is, oh, you know what would be a good way, use of this, you know, epic arc I get to write? Oh, I'm going to use Jordan Peterson and compare him to Nazis. How just sort of juvenile is that from an artistic standpoint? It's simplistic.
Yeah, it's it doesn't take much to be a Nazi these days. Like that's the crazy thing, right? Like in a way, I guess you can see it as you know, progressive, the obvious like extension of progressivism, right? Like it's just we've just quote unquote progressed so much that that if you if you think that men should act like men and that people should be compelled to speak pronouns, then you're a Nazi. But it's dilutes the discussion down to a very religious, and we've talked about this before, a very religious formalism. Like it's basically we've turned back into almost a puritanical sort of vibe.
Right. It makes everything very concrete bound. And what it does for us, and this will sort of lead into our last topic here before we go into the art segment, and I can review a movie and we'll talk about some trailers. But for us, you know, as objectivists, and I think I can speak for you with that, or you can, you know, if you don't want me to speak for you in that way, just tell me. But it takes the humanity out of it. And it really made me think of this article I read in grad school. And it's called The Ethic of Expediency. It's by one of the professors at my school at Clemson. His name is Dr. Katz. Very nice guy, right? Now, I don't agree with everything he said because he comes from a typical leftist, collectivist, pro-government perspective. But that doesn't mean, again, just like with Jordan Peterson, that doesn't mean I throw everything he wrote out. And this Ethic of Expediency deals with Nazis. And it talks about them, and it talks about the, you know, their fundamental errors. You know, it's not talking about the fundamental errors of racism. It's talking about the fundamental errors of their communication. And he's saying by focusing on expediency in their communication, in their technical communication, it dehumanized the people they were exterminating because they would refer to them as things like, you know, units. Right, they wouldn't refer to them as people. And I don't know the exact words they use in their communication and their documents. But it's that idea that if your communication is purely focused on technology, then you're losing the purpose of the technology. Right? Look at the great things, the great tools the Nazi used to do terrible things, right? Train travel, right? Look at the precision of the train travel. Look at the camps they created. Right? They created a machine that was very efficient, but it was an evil machine because their focus was on the expediency of it, not the ends of it, not the humanity of it. And there's a quote at the end of the article that I want to use, that I want to point to. For when expediency becomes an end in itself, or is coupled with personal or political or corporate or scientific or technological goals that are not also and ultimately rooted in humanitarian concerns, as is often the case, ethical problems arise. Now, for us, William, those ethical concerns would be, you know, the love of the self, right? The creation of your best possible life. And we could go into the objectivist ethics and all that, but that's not the point of what I want to make. The point I want to make is when we look at Coates and what he did with Red Skull, and we look at Hollywood, I think that they very much fall prey to this ethic of expediency, that they're not worried about creating an actually good product. They're worried about how can we create this technological machine that can get movies out as quickly as possible and make as much money as quickly as possible. And what we are then seeing then is the end result of that. We're seeing the degradation of Hollywood and of the movie industry. And I mean, this is most commonly seen right now with WB, with the 2-hour movie mandate. And I was thinking about that, right? I was thinking about that when I saw Godzilla versus Kong, when I've seen all the conversations about, you know, everything that's happened with Zack Snyder and Batman versus Superman and Justice League, and people are already complaining about the Mortal Kombat runtime. And I was thinking about what I always say. There's very little falling action in Hollywood anymore. There's very little after the resolution. Well, what's the new world these characters live in? Because it's not about that anymore. It's just about how do we raise your adrenaline? How do we spike your emotions? How do we get you in and out? And then we get more people in and out of the theater. So now I don't want to be clear. I'm not comparing Hollywood to Nazis, but do you see how that same ethic of expediency applies? It's not, oh, how do we make the best possible art and sell that? It's, oh, how do we make this as efficient as possible to get people in and out of the theater and make the most money? And because of that, the storytelling is suffering. And I don't want to say like, oh, it's because we're leading business, you know, we're letting business lead the art. It's because we have no principles guiding us. It's purely pragmatic.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I've been thinking about how there's with the focus of Hollywood on the Chinese market, right? We've seen a lot more exploration of kind of the more Eastern style storytelling versus the Western style storytelling, and you know, we have the whole plot mountain, and you know, everything is integrated with the plot. And in Eastern storytelling, it's not necessarily required to have like a centralized or overarching conflict. It's very much focuses on internal conflict and like how characters react to the world around them, not necessarily like some sort of overarching conflict of, you know, the world is ending or something like that, right? Like in general, those stories are not that part of the story is not required in a sort of Eastern sort of story. The plots are shaped differently, I guess you would say. And I wonder if part of it is that as well, where we're getting sort of a pared down version of Western storytelling, and we're not getting that denouement, right? Because it's just not necessary, right? It's not like the spectacle is all that is needed, and you know, that's what's going to sell, and that's all that really matters.
I think that's certainly part of it, and I'm not necessarily like comfortable with the idea of East versus West here. To me, you know, there's good storytelling, and maybe the better storytelling came out of Western civilization. But even the point of looking at it that way, that Hollywood's looking at it that way, they're not looking at the best movie to sell worldwide. They're saying, what are the elements we need to put into this movie in order to apply or appeal to a Western or an Eastern audience? How many movies have we seen nowadays that are like, oh, we're going to set part of this in China in order to appeal to that audience more? I mean, that just happened with Godzilla versus Kong, right? I mean, obviously it's Godzilla, right? But still, the climax of that movie occurred in Asia. You think that they're not thinking about that when they're writing the script? You think that's not a demand on the script writers?
Yeah, it's definitely becomes a factor. I mean, remember how we used to have movies set in, like, you know, small town America?
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
It doesn't small town anywhere, right? Why don't we set a movie in a small African village?
Yeah, it does not exist.
You tell me there's no good stories you could tell in a small African village in the year 2021? You're telling me there's nothing interesting that happens in that entire continent? What about Australia? There's nothing interesting that happens on the continent of Australia? We couldn't set a movie there? Because no one's thinking about interesting stories to tell anymore in the Hollywood system, is what I'm saying. So just an interesting thought I had. There's a lot of applications of this. And, you know, let's hear what you all have to say about that. But while you all think about that, we leave you forward that. We're going to talk about some other art. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio.
Wasn't focused on
As always, if you'd like to continue the conversation during the week, you can join our Discord. We've had some really great discussion this week. That's where this whole topic about Ayn Rand and Mark Millar came from. You can do so by going to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. Click on any episode link and you can click our join our Discord link and you get the invite code and participate in the conversation. And to follow up on that very briefly, the whole Ayn Rand thing, I tweeted about what we talked about as well, William. I said, you know, we can argue about if Ayn Rand would or wouldn't have said and about her statements in her personal journal, but what matters is the root ideas, not her application of them. The traitor principle, the non-initiation of force, the corruption of second-handedness, these ideas matter. And then somebody who follows me replied, anyone who assumes to put words in Ayn Rand's mouth is a dishonest fool at best. Any attempt to assume her thoughts is an insult to her philosophical achievements and the depth of her integrations. Create your own damn characters and build your own greatness. This, William, is what I mean. The allegiance to Rand over the allegiance to the ideas. That tweet is like, it's angry about the attack on Ayn Rand. And I don't have that anger about it. It's the same thing like when people respond to attacks on Zack Snyder. I don't have that anger about that. Like if someone was like, oh, The Fountainhead is a shit book, that would make me angry. If someone says like, oh, this movie's terrible, that would make me angry. But when people are like, oh man, Zack Snyder's an asshole, I just ignore that. It doesn't mean anything to me. And it's just interesting to me. Do you get what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, do you think it's okay? I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, some people have that little bit of hero worship for Rand or Snyder. Is it okay that some people have this emotional response? Is it, because it's like, you know, to stand up for, if you see something as a mischaracterization of someone who you see as heroic in some way, or even not even heroic, like take that out of it, just as moral, right? There is some value to standing up for that. I'm with you though that it seems weird if you're standing up for the ideas, then you know then it does seem weird that you don't then rhetorically pivot it back to the ideas, right?
Yeah, I don't have an answer. Your question you asked is it good? I don't know. The reason I don't know is I think there's a difference between defending someone who's dead and someone who's alive, right? I think there's a difference in defending the character of someone like Zack Snyder who's alive and someone like Ayn Rand who's dead. So I don't have the answer there. And I also don't have the answer because I think my own personal opinions of Ayn Rand's personal life make that difficult for me. Do you get what I'm saying? I also think that part of as saying the application, I think there's a difference between hero worshiping an artist for who they are versus what they do is different. For instance, I know Tom Brady being married to Gisele Bundchen is a bit more of an environmentalist and a bit more of like a spiritualist and a hippie. And I don't feel the need to defend him for those things because those are not things I agree with him about. But I do have hero worship for him for what he is able to accomplish athletically and off the field for optimizing his athleticism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So it's a complicated issue. And I just found that tweet interesting because to me, and again, to answer your question, I don't know, because even Twitter makes it hard to discern how people are approaching it. It's just like when I see Mark Millar tweet that thing and I see he has that panel from the comic, you know, he tweeted the panel from the comic. It doesn't do anything for me. It's like, okay, here's somebody who doesn't like Ayn Rand personally. This has nothing to do with the ideas. I think artistically there's a more effective way than to be like, oh, here's Ayn Rand and here's something she would have said. Okay. How does that refute the ideas? It refutes the figure. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Okay.
All right, let's move forward. Talk about a review this week. This week, I want to review Chaos Walking. To remind you all, I have instituted a new rating system. This rating system is to give you a better view of why, from my perspective, you should or shouldn't see a movie. It's to better concretize the romantic perspective when it comes to art. There are five basic ratings. The middle one is just bro. It's just a common, like, bro, this is just an average run-of-the-mill movie. There's some good things. There's some bad things. To go to the bad side, it's more cautionary. It's saying, you know, no, bro, don't see this movie. No, bro. And then the worst rating is no. Just no. Just don't see this movie. You know, one's a warning. You know, you can see it if you want. The other one is just don't see it. And then the higher two are praise. There's bromantic. It's saying this movie is bromantic. You know, obviously I would recommend that if I'm saying a movie is bromantic, you should see it. And the highest rating is so bromantic, where this is like the ideal of what you should be able to watch. You know, this is a Man of Steel. This is a La La Land. This is a Shawshank Redemption. Right? These are movies that deal with ideas in a romantic way, and it also has the style that I appreciate. And it also deals with masculinity. To me, as a dude, as a guy, and especially in today's day and age, and maybe this is too close to Jordan Peterson Red Skull. Oh, no. I think it's important for masculinity to be talked about and be talked about positively and to have interesting discussions about masculinity in movies and its relationship to femininity. A good movie discussing femininity as well can be romantic, believe it or not. And I say this whole preamble because that is what Chaos Walking is about. William, are you familiar with the movie Chaos Walking?
I am not, but I'm excited to hear more.
Okay, so Chaos Walking is a sci-fi movie. That's why I asked you if you're familiar with it. Starring Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley. So the basic premise is humans are going out into the galaxy and they're settling other planets. Now, the movie doesn't really show if there are other planets. It's really focused on this one planet. Now, with this, I will say, William, that this movie sort of gave me Stargate SG-1 vibes or Deep Space Nine vibes when they went into the Gamma Quadrant. I remember there was one episode where, like, time went really fast on the planet, but went really, you know, went fast on the planet in comparison to the ship, right, in space. And then I remember there was another episode where you could keep, if you died on the planet, you could keep coming back to life on the planet. But if you left the planet, you would be dead for good because you had died, but it was the planet that kept resurrecting you. So this movie has very much a traditional sci-fi premise in that way. Sort of like, remember I told you The Expanse season 4 reminded me of a long episode of SG-1?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's sort of like that, where this is like a settler's town. So Tom Holland lives in a settler's town where there's only men. And they have this thing called the noise, where their thoughts are audible and create colors or pictures above their head. And if you can control your thoughts, you can get really good at, like, projecting images, or you can get really good at not having thoughts and silencing them. And this town is purely full of men. This settler's town is purely full of men. And it's run by Mads Mikkelsen as the villain. And Mads Mikkelsen runs it in sort of a collectivistic way. Like, we're in this together. You know, I am the circle. The circle is me. And he is in charge, sort of like a dictator. And then, from the second wave of humans, a ship breaks into the atmosphere. But as it breaks in, the men start going nuts because they don't know about the noise. And Daisy Ridley on the ship doesn't know how to deal with it, so the ship crashes and Daisy Ridley's the only one who survives. And the rest of the movie is Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley traveling throughout this planet, learning all about it, and dealing with the concepts of masculinity and femininity as they interact to find hope and find a better future for the two of them because they're young. Right? There's basically two young people in the town, Tom Holland and Nick Jonas, and then Daisy Ridley is the only woman in this town, right? Because all the women are dead in this town. It's all men. So it's all about them, like, what's the future? How do we move forward from this world we've created? Now, on one hand, it would be very easy to look at this movie and be like, oh, this is all about toxic masculinity. And there are elements of that. But what I liked about it is it establishes Tom Holland as a good man. You know, Daisy Ridley even says that later on in the movie. You are a good man. So he is shown as the moral, ethical center, and everyone else around him makes choices that are more or less ethical, and their flaws are shown with their perspectives. And I really like that approach. That's a very romantic approach to it.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of really good things about this movie. A lot of really good things about this movie. Again, it deals with masculinity in this way. And it's also very, very aware of where it situates within the history of science fiction. I mean, I know Daisy Ridley's an astronaut, and that's why she's wearing orange. But, William, she has blonde hair and orange suspenders. Who does that make you think of?
Blonde hair and orange suspenders. No,
think of a sci-fi movie from the 90s.
I don't know, man. What are you trying to pull?
Lilu Dallas, The Fifth Element.
Oh! Okay, alright.
So you are not going to tell me that this is not intentional.
Multipass?
Right, exactly. Because she's the woman that everyone's fighting over because she's the answer that's going to save the universe. Well, it's the same thing on this planet. They all start fighting over her because they don't have a woman. They killed all the women. And that's a little bit of a spoiler. I'm sorry. So she
There's
becomes
walkers
the
in the
answer
barn
to
Lori's pregnant.
Yeah, I'm also trying not to spoil this movie. So she's the answer. And I think that reference to The Fifth Element is very intentional. Because otherwise, they could have done this movie with her with dark hair and it would have been the same. But unless you're trying to bring out that imagery, I don't see any other reason why you would have her dressed that way and have that hair color. It has to be a reference to The Fifth Element. And that's what I appreciate about this. It's aware of the sci-fi tropes, but it's also not trying to not be a sci-fi movie.
Okay.
It reminds me of, you know, I already said SG-1, but there are also elements of, you know, The Walking Dead, right? This is post-apocalyptic. How are these societies existing? So this, in a way, could have been a television series. They could have done this in long form. So it's interesting to also look at it from an intellectual perspective and say, would this have been better as a TV series? Maybe that's a knock against it. Maybe it isn't. But the biggest, now I'm going to say the biggest knock. The biggest knock I would have on this movie is what I said. After the resolution, after the climax, there's one scene which is sort of, what's the new world we live in for these two main characters? And from there, it's supposed to be like, okay, now they have hope. And to me, they spend a lot of good time at the beginning establishing the world Tom Holland lives in before Daisy Ridley shows up. And then at the end, it cheapens it to not have that payoff. Still, I would like to say that I would rate this movie romantic. I think they could have gone more in depth into these ideas, which, you know, again, maybe it would have been better as a trilogy or two movies or a TV series. I think it is based on a book, so maybe the book is better. But this was executed very well. It had me interested. It had me invested. I'm not going to lie. I cried at one point. It should have been obvious to me what was going to happen based upon something that was done just from a shooting standpoint that's usually not done. And I was like, why are they doing this? And then it got to a point and I was like, okay, I get it now. I don't want to say what it is because it'll spoil it. But when you watch the movie, it was getting to the point that I was kind of making fun of it in my own head because it was ridiculous. But there was a payoff to it and it was a good payoff to it. So, yes, I would say see this movie. This is a romantic movie, Chaos Walking. I was very pleasantly surprised. I went in with sort of tepid expectations, but I came out and I had a really good time. One of the better movies I've seen in a while. And if you're into sci-fi, William, I think, you know, you would like it.
All right. I'm going to add it to the list. It is a part, I guess the books are a trilogy.
So, okay, so yeah. Proving my point, right?
Yeah.
Showing my storytelling instincts.
There you go.
Well, let's talk about some other storytelling instincts where we like to watch trailers and sort of say what we think is going to happen, or not necessarily what we think is going to happen, but how we think these movies are going to be. We do it every week. Now I post the trailers in our Discord, so you can join our Discord and you can watch the trailers either, you know, before or after the episode or during the episode. You know, you can watch a trailer, listen to the episode, watch a trailer, listen to the episode.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The Woman in the Window is a Netflix movie starring Amy Adams, and it's sort of Rear Window meets the COVID-19 pandemic. And I don't mean to say it takes place during the COVID-19 pandemic, but Amy Adams is agoraphobic. She's a recluse and she lives at home, but then she sees what she thinks is a murder across the hall. See how this is very similar to Rear Window? And she starts trying to get out and trying to help, but then the entire world tells her she's crazy and she didn't see reality properly. So to me, I see a lot of interesting ideas in this trailer, William. I mean, we're all living at home, or we were during quarantine, and we have these devices that people on us basically gaslight us in this way and tell us, oh, your understanding of reality and what you're perceiving isn't actually happening. And we're still dealing with that. So I think this movie can be an interesting concretization of all of these ideas. I love Amy Adams. I've loved her since, you know, way before she was ever involved with Zack Snyder movies. I mean, The Fighter, her performance in that. I love that movie. She's tremendous in that. Her performance in this looks great. The fact that it's Netflix only makes me a little worried, although Netflix is clearly branching out, trying to make legitimate movies, trying to do, you know, do more than, you know, the teen comedy where the guy's penis was cut off and they had to get it back to him by hiking through the wilderness and get it back in time to have it sewn on, right? They're trying to move beyond those sort of ridiculous movies just to get people to click. So I have some hope for this, but it is definitionally a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
Yeah, this looks like a interesting sort of psychological drama. And not usually my first choice for a movie, but I think I could sit by the fireplace and enjoy some of this. I think we've all, like you said, we've all lived in this world of being disconnected, and this concept of people trying to gaslight you is another thing I think we've all been living through lately. So I'll give this a Netflix and hug as well.
Netflix and hug. Second trailer.
Too Late is described as a horror comedy, although the trailer didn't have much of the horror in it. It also wasn't very funny. Now, that's not a knock against it. This trailer is about a woman who's a wannabe stand-up comic, but she's spending all her time working for a late-night show. It has a quote in it that very much describes Hollywood. And it's a mentality that people sort of accept in Hollywood, which I think is sort of negative, where she says, and this is a paraphrase, you know, I think we go into life expecting to be one thing and then we just end up doing something we never anticipated. Again, that's a paraphrase. But it's this idea that Hollywood gets to decide what role you have in the industry. You don't get to decide what role you have in the industry. So this is probably a cynical take on life in general, a cynical take on the world in general. The fact that it's official selection to the Seattle Film Festival is a sign of concern for me. Anytime Seattle deems something good art, we know how far left their perspective is in that city. So even though I love horror comedy, I don't have any affinity for this movie. I love horror comedy. It's one of my favorite genres. It's just this trailer was a very poorly made trailer, William. And all the signs in it indicate to me that even though this is an interesting premise and it could be done well, it just doesn't seem like it's going to be executed that well. Tackle.
Yeah. Is the fact that they're about comedians what makes it a horror comedy? Like, I completely agree with you. There was nothing in here that I was thinking this is going to be funny. The trailer
made supposed
it seem
to make
like
it funny, but the horror is supposed to be, I think the late night host is like a horror monster.
Right. Yeah. And it's unclear whether she's killing people or just flashing her headlights. I'm not sure what's going on with that part either. I had no idea what was going on, and there was nothing about this that really struck me as something that had an interesting story to tell. I think maybe you understand, because this is a genre you're very into, that you understood more of the tropes, the horror tropes, that maybe were clear to you. But I just left I had to watch it twice, because the first time I was just confused. I was like, wait, what is this about? Right? What is this really about? And it took me until the second viewing to realize, oh, I think they're implying that the host is a monster, and maybe the chick is too. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. So I was just confused. So I'm going to tackle.
Tackle. Third trailer.
Mainstream is a film by Gia Coppola starring Andrew Garfield. It's about the world of YouTube celebrity. Andrew Garfield plays a YouTube celebrity sort of in the vein of Logan Paul, where he markets himself as essentially, I'm nobody, you shouldn't want to watch me, but you do because of look at the crazy things I do and look at the lifestyle I live. And I think the movie is not from his perspective, but from the perspective of a young woman who's trying to get into this community, who forges a bond with him, he reaches out to, and tries to sort of like grow her career with her, collaborate with her. This trailer is interesting to me. I worry that it's showing all the best parts and that this movie is actually a lot slower and more naturalistic. That's my biggest concern with this movie. I will say, though, that this performance in this trailer alone by Andrew Garfield is masterful. This is the best I've ever seen him be. It's just phenomenal. And that alone sort of makes me want to watch it. But the content of this could be very good. The thematic content, the intellectual, philosophical content of this movie could be very good. So based upon that, based upon who the director is, and based upon what looks like an incredible performance by Andrew Garfield, I will give this movie a chance. Hug.
Yeah, there's a lot of meat on this trailer that make it interesting. I think, you know, one of the things in you sort of it's sort of a commentary on YouTuber and you know, sort of the Instagram culture, right? And it will be interesting to see what direction they take it. One of the original reasons, the YouTube community took off was at least this concept or this presentation of being authentic, right? And one of the worst things that can happen to your YouTube channel as a small to medium creator is for people to see something as inauthentic, right? But then the Vine invasion happened, right? And then the Fire Nation came, and there was. That authenticity kind of changed and is much more manufactured. So it'd be interesting to see what direction this goes, just as what it's going to comment on, and what really the conflict is. Justin, was it clear to you what really was the conflict here? Is that authenticity theme kind of where the conflict's going to be?
I think it's the authenticity theme coalescing with a destructive lifestyle. What I would guess is, based upon the approach, it's about this woman coming into this life, thinking it's awesome, and then realizing how corrupt it is. And the corruption is likely a result of the inauthenticity, which is part of why I say thematically it seems so appealing. Because if you do that story right, it can be an excellent story.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think I'd be down to watch this. So I'm going to give it a hug.
Hug? Final trailer.
Cruella is Disney's latest perspective movie from the villain's perspective. Sort of like if you remember Maleficent they did a few years ago. It's a long time ago now, right? I don't even know how many years it's been since Maleficent came out. Seems like forever. But, you know, that was a movie starring Angelina Jolie from the perspective of the villain of Sleeping Beauty. This one is sort of an origin story perspective movie from Cruella of 101 Dalmatians starring Emma Stone. And I want to be specific here that we are talking, I want to be clear here that we are talking about the second trailer. Because the first trailer for this movie was complete and utter trash. And I knew I was going to see this movie. Because this is something Christine, my fiance, wants to see. So I was like, okay, I'll see this. Like, it looks like it would, you know, like, it's not going to be bad production value-wise. But the first movie trailer for this, when they, like, show her saying, I'm Cruella, like, her delivery's terrible. It's very cliche. But this trailer delves more into who she is and why she becomes what she becomes. And it's about her, you know, her and the fashion world, sort of like a darker version of The Devil Wears Prada. Not that I ever saw that movie, but that's sort of the impression I got of it, where, you know, Emma Thompson is very corrupt. Her boss is very corrupt. And that corruptness leads to Cruella becoming even more corrupt, sort of like an escalation. And that could be, if that's the story they go with this, that could be an interesting demonstration of how true villainy arises through the escalation of the lack of principles. And in a way, it goes back to what I was saying earlier in the episode with the ethic of expediency. Emma Thompson sort of, and I can't remember exactly what she just said, which is why I'm talking around it. I can't remember exactly what she said in the trailer, her character, but it was very much, you know, taking the humanity out of things. And it's like, if you're going to take the humanity out of things, Cruella escalates it even further. And then it has sort of like a Sweeney Todd vibe to the way she acts and dresses and everything. And everything in this trailer, the second trailer, comes off a lot better than the first trailer. So at first I was sort of, okay, I'll see this, whatever. I'm not excited, but I have legitimate interest in seeing what they do with this movie now, especially because Emma Stone looks a million times better in this trailer than the first one. So this movie went from like, okay, I'm going to see it reluctantly, to hug.
Hug.
All right, I'm going to have to take the opposite view here. I've just not enjoyed the... I haven't even been able to sit through a live action Disney remake. I come in this with a healthy amount of skepticism. It seemed like, while I agree with you that the character seemed interesting, I just don't know how this plot is even going to be enjoyable, right? Like, there's not a lot there, and it makes me just want to... I have seen Devil Wears Prada. I'd kind of rather watch that than this. I don't know. I don't know why. There was something about just the... If they're going to be... I feel like the style, I think that's what it really comes down to. It's trying to be over the top in ways, which I appreciate, and be a little more expressive. But at least in the trailer, it seemed limited, hampered by the fact that it's not animated, right? And I don't know. This seemed like something that would be better explored in an animated version. And I don't know. I just didn't find it interesting. So I'm going to give this a very soft tackle.
Tackle.
And I want to be clear that this isn't a live action remake. It's like a live action prequel. Whereas like the remakes, like yeah. They're actually taking the movies and remaking them, so it's a little bit different there.
Well, after you watch it, maybe you can let me know. But I don't know. It seemed like toxic femininity, the movie, you know?
Yeah, and... no, I'll definitely review it, and I have the same sort of concerns you do. And that's the other thing, is it may have been that the first trailer was so bad and this one is such a 180 from it that it's just like, I'm like, wow, maybe that's
you're like, which movie is it? Right. Is it the first
right.
trailer
it might be,
or the second
It might
trailer?
Be tinting my perspective. I'd be interested for William off show if you want to watch that first trailer and tell me what you think the difference okay. of the two trailers is, just because I'd be interested to see maybe, you know, you see how bad that was and you understand like why my perspective is so different.
Okay.
All right. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that it's going to cost us $100 per episode to generate NFT tokens for each Midside episode. And with, gosh, what season are we on? Season 11? That's a lot of NFT episodes, or NFTs to generate. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned what an NFT was exactly, and I have a much better understanding of it. And I feel like I have a pretty good opinion on NFTs now. So I hope people found that educational. You know, usually we don't have such educational content, but I think we had good educational content. Likewise, I think I have a clearer view of my view on sort of objectivism versus Ayn Rand, and, you know, liking the ideas versus liking her as a person, and liking any sort of creator versus their art. And the art versus the person themselves. As always, I'd like to thank you all for listening. This show is often just me ranting into a microphone, and then there's 10 seconds of silence where William figures out what to say to what I just said. I would imagine that's a similar experience to you have, that you all have. And remember that if nobody listened, this would just be me ranting into a microphone. So I appreciate you all listening. I especially appreciate our Liberty.me listeners. I really don't like how Objectivists, and this is kind of Justin Dunks on Objectivists, the episode, so the Justin Dunks on Objectivists edition. So sorry, Objectivists, but I really don't like how Objectivists like antagonize libertarians. Because again, you know, there is a difference between the belief systems, right? One's political, one's philosophical, right? So we have a different application of, or I will say I have a different application. Objectivists tend to have a different application of philosophy to politics, so they tend to dunk on and distance themselves with libertarians. I'm not interested in doing that. I think that's very esoteric. And I think if we got our society to debate between those two, we'd have a very healthy, happy society. So I consider you all brothers and sisters more than I consider you all enemies. So I really appreciate the libertarian listeners, the liberty.me listeners. If any of our listeners want to help support the show, they can do so through patreon.com or the mid or locals, right? The midside.com/patreon, midside.com/locals. Locals is per month. Patreon is per episode. That's what helps us keep the light on. That's what helps us keep the show going. You can buy my novel, The Cut, right? It's a based on a true story version of what happened behind the scenes of the production of Justice League. Check that out. I see a lot of conversation nowadays where people are like, oh, wow, this story is really interesting. Well, read my story then. You'd enjoy it. And as always, the best thing you can do to grow this show is to tell a friend. Discord has been popping off recently, and I want to see that growing. I want to see more people in there talking. I want to grow the Midside community because it makes my life better. My show, this is the 9th season, William, not the 11th. My life has become better because of the 9 seasons of the show, and I mean that legitimately. I've made some really good friends through people finding this show and finding me, and I'd like that to continue growing this community. I'd like other people to find friends because of that, and I'd like other people to find joy because of this show. So tell a friend. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Nemlesnesky reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a non-fungible day. Does 9 count the lost seasons?
Oh, so yeah, this would technically be the 10th season. It doesn't count the lost season.
There we go.
So the 10th season.
I'm not crazy.
Well, most people don't know about the lost season, William. You were probably like our only listener back then.